if properly promoted, the argument could prevent many who fell for the misinterpretation of Takfiriism from joining extremist and terrorist groups that have wreaked havoc on the region and become a global threat. In his memoirs, when he visits Pope John Paul II, Ayatollah Mesbah writes, "I told Pope John Paul II that humanity was suffering from two evils, ideological corruption and moral corruption. Ideological corruption means forgetting God in our daily lives, and moral corruption means the current immorality that prevails in the world. To fight this global plight, Muslim and Christian leaders can play an important role. Their cooperation can alleviate this plight." Ayatollah Muhammad Taghi Mesbah Yazdi is definitely an outstanding figure in the Muslim world. Yet his lifelong efforts as a Muslim scholar and philosopher was meant to help all humanity in a world of confusing ideologies and schools of thought, where God is said to be dead, and man in exile and abandoned to himself.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight. Vice President Mike Pence signaled support on Saturday for a futile Republican bid to overturn the election in Congress next week, after 11 Republican senators and senators-elect said they would vote to reject President-elect Joseph R. Biden's victory when the House of Representatives and Senate meet to formally certify it. The announcement by the senators and Mr. Pence's move to endorse it reflected a groundswell among Republicans to defy the unambiguous results of the election and indulge President Donald Trump's attempts to remain in power with false claims of voting fraud. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times columnists Luke Broadwater, Maggie Haberman, and Thomas Kaplan. The piece is titled "Pence Welcomes Futile Bid by GOP Lawmakers to Overturn Election." U.S. Vice President Mike Pence signaled support on Saturday for a futile Republican bid to overturn the election in Congress next week, after 11 Republican senators and senators-elect said they would vote to reject President-elect Joseph R. Biden's victory when the House of Representatives and Senate meet to formally certify it. The announcement by the senators and Mr. Pence's move to endorse it reflected a groundswell among Republicans to defy the unambiguous result of the election and indulge in President Donald Trump's attempts to remain in power with false claims of voting fraud. "Every state in the country has certified the election results after verifying their accuracy, many following post-election audits or hand counts. Judges across the country and a Supreme Court with a conservative majority have rejected nearly 60 attempts by Donald Trump and his allies to challenge the election results. And neither Mr. Pence nor any of the senators who said they would vote to invalidate the election has made a specific allegation of fraud, instead offering vague suggestions that some wrongdoing might have occurred and asserting that many of their supporters believe that it has. The senator's opposition to certifying Joe Biden's election victory will not change the outcome, but it guarantees that what would normally be a perfunctory session on Capitol Hill on Wednesday to ratify the result of the presidential election will instead become a partisan brawl, in which Republicans amplify specious claims of widespread election rigging that have been debunked and dismissed for weeks, even as Donald Trump has stoked them. The spectacle promises to set a caustic backdrop for Joe Biden's inauguration in the coming weeks and reflects the polarized politics on Capitol Hill that will be among his greatest challenges. It will also pose a political dilemma for Republicans, forcing them to choose between accepting the results of a Democratic election, even if it means angering supporters who dislike the outcome and could punish them at the polls, and joining their colleagues in displaying unflinching loyalty to President Donald Trump, who has demanded in increasingly angry fashion that they back his bid to cling on to power and to the presidency. The conundrum is especially acute for Mike Pence, who, as President of the Senate, has the task of presiding over next Wednesday's proceedings and declaring Mr. Biden the winner, but has his own future political aspirations to consider as well. On Friday, a federal judge dismissed a lawsuit brought by House Republicans to pressure Mike Pence to do otherwise and instead unilaterally overturn the results. But on Saturday evening, Mark Short, Mike Pence's chief of staff, issued a statement saying that Mr. Pence shares the concerns of millions of Americans about voter fraud and irregularities in the last election. The vice president, the statement continued, welcomes the efforts of members of the House and Senate to use the authority they have under the law to raise objections and bring forward evidence before the Congress and the American people on 6th of January. Joint statement on Saturday, the Senate Republicans, including seven senators and four who are to be sworn in on Sunday, called for a 10-day audit of election returns in disputed states and said they would vote to reject their electors from those states until an audit was completed. They did not elaborate on which states. The group is led by Senator Ted Cruz from Texas and includes Senators Ron Johnson of Wisconsin, James Lankford of Oklahoma, Steve Daines of Montana, John Kennedy of Louisiana, Marsha Blackburn of Tennessee, and Mike Braun of Indiana, and Senators-elect Cynthia Loomis of Wyoming, Roger Marshall of Kansas, Bill Hagerty of Tennessee, and Tommy Tuberville of Alabama. Together with Senator Josh Hawley of Missouri, who announced this week that he would object to Congress's certification of the election results, they bring to nearly one quarter the proportion of Senate Republicans who have broken with their leaders to join the effort to invalidate Joe Biden's victory. In the House of Representatives, where a band of conservatives has been plotting the last-ditch election objection for weeks, more than half of the Republicans joined a failed lawsuit seeking to overturn the will of the voters, and more are expected to support the effort to challenge the results in Congress next week. Representative Mo Brooks, Republican from Alabama, has said he will object to certifying the results, and with Josh Hawley's support, that challenge would hold weight, prompting senators and representatives to retreat to their chambers on opposite sides of the Capitol for a two-hour debate and then a vote on whether to disqualify a state's votes. Both the democratically controlled House of Representatives and Republican controlled Senate would have to agree to toss out a state's electoral votes, something that has not happened since the 19th century and is not expected to happen this time. In their statement, the Republicans cited poll results showing most members of their party believed the election was rigged, an assertion that Donald Trump has made for months, and which has been repeated in the right-wing news media and by many Republican members of Congress. A fair and credible audit, conducted expeditiously and completed well before 20th of January, would dramatically improve Americans' faith in our electoral process and would significantly enhance the legitimacy of whoever becomes our next president, they wrote. We are acting not to thwart the democratic process, but rather to protect it. They also acknowledged that their effort was likely to be unsuccessful, given that any such challenge must be sustained by both the House of Representatives, where Democrats have a majority, and the U.S. Senate, where top Republicans, include Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, the majority leader, have tried to shut it down. We fully expect most, if not all, Democrats, and perhaps more than a few Republicans, to vote otherwise, the senators wrote. Senator Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota, the top Democrat on the Rules Committee, with jurisdiction over federal elections, called the Republican effort a publicity stunt that would ultimately fail, but said it was dangerous nevertheless, amounting to an attempt to subvert the will of the voters. Amy Klobuchar noted in an interview that hundreds of millions of votes had already been counted, recounted, litigated, and state certified across the country. These baseless claims have already been examined and dismissed by Trump's own attorney general, dozens of courts of law, and election officials from both parties, said Mike Gwynn, a spokesman for Mr. Biden's campaign. While lawmakers have sought to register their opposition to past presidential election results by challenging Congress's certification, the move has generally been more symbolic than substantive, given that the loser had already conceded and senators rarely joined with members of the House to force a vote. But as Donald Trump continues to perpetuate the myth of widespread voter fraud, a growing number of Republicans in Congress have been eager to challenge the results, either out of devotion to the president or out of fear of enraging the base of their party that still reveres him even in defeat. That is the case even though the vast majority of them just won elections in the very same balloting they are now claiming was fraudulently administered. Mr. Mitch McConnell has discouraged senators from joining the House effort, and Senator John Thune of South Dakota, the number two Republican in the Senate, told reporters the challenge to the election results would fail in the Senate like a shot dog, prompting a Twitter rebuke from President Donald Trump. Senator Ben Sasse, Republican from Nebraska, on Thursday condemned the attempt, calling it a dangerous ploy intended to disenfranchise millions of Americans. Senator Ben Sasse accused fellow Republicans of making a political calculation to try to further their careers at the expense of the truth by tapping into Donald Trump's populist base. But Josh Holmes, a Republican strategist and Mitch McConnell's former chief of staff, warned that those involved in the effort would come to regret their stance. Rarely can you predict with 100% assurance that years from now everyone who went down this road will wish they had a mulligan, Mr. Holmes wrote on Twitter. Senator Patrick Toomey, a Pennsylvania Republican who has announced that he will not seek re-election in 2022, also blasted the effort, saying that Mr. Josh Hawley, Ted Cruz, and others were directly undermining the right of the people to elect their own leaders. For years, Donald Trump has railed against contests in which he has lost, disliked the outcome, or feared he might be defeated. He objected to the results of the Emmys, falsely claimed President Barack Obama did not win the popular vote, asserted that Ted Cruz stole a primary victory from him in Iowa in 2016, and predicted that the election in which he defeated the Democratic nominee Hillary Clinton would be rigged. In the months leading up to November's election, he also warned that he would be cheated out of a victory and refused to commit to a peaceful transfer of power. As for Joe Biden, racked up victories in November, Mr. Trump indulged in increasingly outlandish fictions, spreading disinformation about the election results and encouraging his followers to challenge the vote at every step of the way. In recent weeks, as his legal defeats have stacked up, the president has become more vitriolic in his condemnation of Republicans who failed to support his false claims of having been the true victor in the election, and has lavished praise on those who parrot his accusations. On Saturday, Donald Trump cheered on the Republican senators who announced they would object to certifying the election results, writing on Twitter, "Our country will love them for it." The vote tally and procedures in every battleground state that Donald Trump contests have been affirmed through multiple post-election audits. Joe Biden won the election with over 7 million more votes than Donald Trump, and with 306 electoral college votes, surpassing the threshold of 270 needed to win the presidency. Nevertheless, more than a month after Joe Biden's victory, with increasing numbers in their party marching in lockstep with Donald Trump, some Republicans felt the need on Saturday to explain why they plan to vote to uphold the results of the election, of a Democratic election. "I swore an oath of allegiance to support and defend the Constitution of the United States, and that is what I will do on 6th of January," Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska said in a statement. She is to face voters next November. Senator Mitt Romney of Utah warned of the consequences of backing a bid to subvert the election's outcome. "I could never have imagined seeing these things in the greatest democracy in the world," Mitt Romney said in a statement. "Has ambition so eclipsed principle?"
The Israeli regime has always prided itself on being the home of the latest cyber technology, boasting about its capabilities in both aggressive and defensive cyber warfare. However, it seems that the regime has counted its eggs a little too early, as a sophisticated hack has shown the real side of Israeli cybersecurity. The hack, which appears to have taken place over a period of months, appears to be from a source known as Pay2Key, with the hackers deploying a form of highly sophisticated ransomware designed to extract high quantities of information from its target, as well as demanding £100,000 in Bitcoin to stop leaks going public. It seems that the hack targeted a cybersecurity company by the name of Portnox, which itself appears to be a major provider of cybersecurity to multiple Israeli regime offices, including the Israeli aerospace industry, El Al, Bezaq, and Clalit Healthcare, many of which have direct links to the Israeli regime and defense systems. Evidence also suggests that much of the information which is threatening to be leaked contains secret information about various Israeli defense networks and companies, which, although not apparent to what exact details are involved, could see highly classified and sensitive Israeli secrets flooded into the public domain. A spokesman for another Israeli cybersecurity company, Clear Sky, announced that the damage done by the hackers has caused significant damage to the Israeli regime, and has pointed the finger of blame at Iran as the origin of the attack, raising the question as to just what right does Israel have to put the onus on Iran after the acts the Israeli regime has committed on the country, including, of course, the famous Stuxnet bug, which targeted Iran's peaceful civilian nuclear program.
Even if Iran Iranians were responsible for this latest cyber attack, and indeed the Israeli press has not ascertained culpability yet, and so it said clearly that it can't determine whether or not Iranians were involved. But even if Iranians were involved in this latest cyber attack, Israel would be in no position to complain about it, having taken the cyber gloves off, if you will, by initiating cyber war directly against Iran in 2009 and 10 with the Stuxnet sabotage cyber campaign. This was a campaign of the United States and Israel under the code name Operation Olympic Games, which was designed to destroy elements of Iran's civilian nuclear energy program.
The finger of blame has been pointed at Iran yet again, this time by the Israeli regime. Yet just earlier this month, the US also pointed towards Iran for a series of hacks that were alleged to have breached US voting procedures and officials, something that Iran denied as nonsense. But it seems that Israel is no stranger to cyber attacks themselves, with others predating the Pay2 Key attack. Earlier this year, more than 1,000 Israeli websites were hacked, with images of Tel Aviv in flames, warning Israel that the countdown to destruction had begun, with the Israeli building up a host of enemies due to its hostile actions around the world, from the displacement of people in Palestine to the participation of acts of state-sponsored terrorism. Is it any wonder that Tel Aviv is on the radar of multiple hackers from unknown locations? With such attacks proving that the Israeli regime is both ill-equipped to deal with attacks and too hasty in claiming to be a world leader in security-related issues, has the regime then lost its place at the top of the charts when it comes to cyber and electronic technology?
I believe that this latest hack demonstrates that truly all systems are vulnerable to potential cyber attack. And considering the fact that Israel prides itself so much on its high technology and its cybersecurity, this just proves that even the Israeli cybersecurity can be broken. And so this raises the question, why play with fire, especially when fire will be fought with fire?
There's no doubt that the hack is, and may further yet to prove, a huge embarrassment for the Israeli regime, in particular as the details of the information obtained is yet to be revealed by the hackers, and is similar in nature to a recent hack on US bodies, which the US alleged originated from Russia. Yet with allegations flying around, the priority now for the Israeli regime is to hope that the information obtained does not fall into the public domain and further shame the regime that appears to have no shame.
As the coronavirus pandemic continues to surge across the world, many countries have started mass vaccinations in an effort to bring the virus under control. From Europe to Latin America, many nations have imported vaccines in large quantities to help their people get rid of the highly infectious disease. Iran, however, has managed to come up with its own domestically produced COVID-19 vaccine. The country has now begun testing the inoculation on humans after successfully completing the initial steps, including tests on animals and obtaining necessary approvals. The human trial of the vaccine was initiated at the headquarters of executing the order of Imam Khomeini in the capital Tehran on Tuesday. A total of 56 volunteers will gradually receive injections during the first stage. The vaccine, Coviran Barakat, is named after the pharmaceutical group behind its development. The achievement comes as Iranian authorities have been critical of the U.S. for hindering the country's efforts to buy a vaccine from abroad. Many believe the Iranian-made vaccine proves the country's enhanced capabilities despite U.S. sanctions.
Necessity is the mother of invention, they say, and the Iranian people needed a vaccine. The U.S. Maximum pressure campaign denied them access to the vaccines. And so the Iranian people, their scientists, their government, had to go the extra mile to be resilient and develop their own domestic vaccine. It's a remarkable achievement, but it's the kind of thing that is an unintended consequence of campaigns of maximum pressure and hybrid warfare against countries. People learn to be self-sufficient, to be reliant, and they make new alliances with other countries in the military, economic, and political spheres, and that's exactly what Iran has done.
On Saturday, Iran's President Hassan Rouhani once again lashed out at Washington, saying its wicked activities have caused trouble for Tehran to acquire vaccines. Earlier this month, the head of Iran's central bank also slammed the U.S. administration for its sanctions, which he said have been hampering efforts to purchase the inoculation. Abdel Nasser Hemmati said Iran is prepared to purchase the vaccine through the World Health Organization, but it is unable to transfer the required money due to what he called inhumane U.S. sanctions. Hemmati, however, expressed hope that the vaccine-related transactions will be facilitated through other channels. The administration of U.S. President Donald Trump unilaterally pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal in May 2018. Since then, American officials have targeted every Iranian sector with sanctions ever enforced against any nation. The U.S. economic pressure has prompted the Iranian officials to take a tactical step against such measures. Earlier this month, leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, urged officials to focus on neutralizing the sanctions apart from securing their removal. The leader even cautioned against trusting the enemies and warned that U.S. hostilities toward Iran will not end once President Trump leaves office. But from the medical field to the military complex, technology, and a whole host of other fields, Iran has advanced its know-how domestically thanks to the U.S. maximum pressure campaign and sanctions.
Clearly, the U.S. campaign of maximum pressure has not succeeded in overturning the government of the Islamic Republic, and in fact has made it stronger and more resilient. And an unintended consequence of all of this maximum pressure campaign has been to force Iran and other countries under the thumb of the U.S. to become more self-reliant and to seek other trading arrangements, other military arrangements, other political alliances. And the end result is that the U.S. empire is now declining, and it will continue to decline at an ever-accelerating pace.
But the U.S. measures are not bound to sanctions alone. Washington and its allies, namely Israel, have a long history of using other evil tactics to prevent Tehran from its advancements. That includes the assassination of Iranian scientists, with Mohsen Fakhrizadeh being the latest victim of U.S. and Israeli plots. Fakhrizadeh is not the only Iranian scientist assassinated by the American and Israeli agents, and probably will not be the last one.
The U.S. and many of the G20 countries engage in regimes of economic sanctions and programs of hybrid warfare against a number of countries with the point of bringing these countries under their control. The U.S. is an empire, and it uses campaigns of hybrid warfare, which included, for example, the targeted assassinations of General Soleimani and the nuclear scientist, Dr. Fakhrizadeh. Includes economic sanctions. It includes continuing attacks in the mainstream media. It includes lawfare initiatives against the government of Iran. And it does all this in the hope of bringing down the Iranian government.
Probably they forget the fact that the advancement of a nation does not depend on one person. Eliminating icons like Fakhrizadeh will, of course, be felt for long, but will not stop Iran from going forward. The U.S. anti-Iran moves also raise questions as who is the United States really targeting by using all possible means to block a country's progress, be it hampering efforts to buy a coronavirus vaccine or anything else.
From the very start, there was no doubt that the EU would not give the British a deal that would match any of the conditions met by being a member of the EU. So when Johnson and von der Leyen announced a deal had been struck, why then did the UK hail it as a victory? But with the details yet to be fully made public, many people are labelling the deal as a sham for the British, clearly suggesting that the EU negotiators, led by Michel Barnier, stood firm to the end and made sure that the EU did not come out the loser on the deal. According to one French source familiar with the exact details of the paper and who wished to remain anonymous, it seems that the British made huge concessions, giving up many of the terms and conditions they claimed they would fight for. However, it seems that ultimately the British team had no choice but to cave in. Several days after the deal was announced, EU and British officials and lawmakers are poring over the details. The document is rumoured to be some 1,200 pages long, but once read and digested, will demonstrate just how many concessions the UK finally gave into and reveal just exactly what Boris Johnson tried to hide on announcement day.
Brexit is a disaster, an absolute disaster, and it's one that Boris Johnson is like hugely responsible for just by himself. I mean, as a journalist, he did his very best to poison the waters between the UK and the EU. He succeeded, the referendum passed, and now Britain is facing the reality, just a few days away, of a forcible separation from the continent.
What was clear from Johnson's announcement is that nothing new has come from the deal, with Britain claiming victory over its borders, freedom of movement, and trade criteria, all things that, with a deal or not, Britain would have had anyway. So where then does the victory lie for Whitehall? Johnson's next task is to win over the hardline Brexiteers, many of whom who wanted to leave the EU without a deal, claiming that Britain will be fine on its own. However, it seems that Johnson may have already convinced many to fall in line, as any sign of division now by the British would send a message to the world that the deal was in fact a disaster for the UK, a message that Britain can ill afford to leak out. The British made numerous promises prior to the announcement of the deal between Britain and the EU. Some of these promises included protecting the rights of British fishermen, farmers and businesses. Yet it seems, as details slowly emerge, not all are happy about the deal. British fishermen, for one, have already started claiming that they've been sold out by Boris Johnson as they face sharing British waters with EU fishermen for the next 5.5 years, only increasing their quota from 10% to 20%, suggesting that not much will change. But when it comes to the financial value of fishing in the UK, one has to really question the fishing industry culture. With fishing making up only 0.1% of the overall British GDP, is it any wonder then that Johnson failed to push hard for a fair deal, raising the question as to just what else he folded on?
There are several. There are the question of fishing rights, which apparently he had to give more ground than he wanted to. Which essentially gives the EU greater rights in the English Channel than British fishermen had wanted to grant. The other one involves business services, and that's really quite unclear as to what will happen. The agreement is 1,200 pages long, so no one at this point is quite sure what's in it.
For Johnson, and all in favour of Brexit, a long road lies ahead before the full impact of Brexit becomes clear. But what's for sure is the level of uncertainty and division that lies ahead. For a start, Scotland will no doubt seek a second independence referendum, sparking a chain reaction that will likely see the north of Ireland request to be united with the Republic of Ireland, causing a breakup of the UK, something that seems an inevitable consequence of Brexit. From the EU perspective, Britain, it seems, is a spent force, a country living in the fading memories of past glory, and slowly but surely, floating further away from Europe, something that the EU, for one, will be happy to watch sinking on the horizon.
The United Arab Emirates has become a trade hub in the region, with strong links across West and South Asia and Europe. The country has, among other things, been trying to establish itself as a large and fast-growing marketplace for gold. According to data collected by the Observatory for Economic Complexity, the UAE's gold imports have increased by an average of 58% to over $27 billion in 2018. The Arab country's fondness for gold comes amid its plummeting oil reserves and the UAE's drive to diversify its economy. Gold has proven to be a lucrative commodity in the past months, particularly as investors favored the precious metal as a safe haven during the uncertainties in other markets as the coronavirus pandemic hit. The importance of gold for Dubai's economy is such that its trade volume surpassed that of diamonds, oil, jewelry, and cell phones in 2019.
The United Arab Emirates has no gold on its own, as is clear. They have oil, but they have no gold yet. Gold is their second largest export. So all of their 17.7 billion of their gold export is being imported first and washed or laundered by re-exporting it mainly through the UK into Switzerland and other gold refining places like India.
But there's another side to this story. The United Kingdom's Home Office and Treasury issued a report on money laundering and terrorist financing, labeling the UAE as vulnerable to illicit activities due to a lax policing of gold movements across the country. But how does the UAE acquire all that gold? And where does the country buy the exorbitant amount of precious metal from? According to investigations conducted by The Sentry, an NGO that tracks dirty money linked to African war criminals, 95% of gold officially exported from Central and East Africa, much of it mined in Sudan, South Sudan, the Central African Republic, and the Democratic Republic of Congo, ends up in the Emirates. Gold has funded armed conflicts in the region for years, but the jump in prices in the past few months has turned the metal into new blood diamonds, as it's been increasingly obtained through brutal mining practices and illicit profits, including the use of underage workers.
First, the international gold laundering is a gigantic human rights abuse, foremost because it uses many countries in Africa, in South America, are using massive child labor. Children not only are put in tremendous risks working in the mines, in narrow, rickety underground tunnels that could collapse anytime, and often do. But they are also poisoned on a daily basis by chemicals used in extracting gold from the rock.
In 2016, the UAE declared gold imports from 25 African countries worth $7.4 billion, which had not declared any exports to the UAE. The Emirates declared $3.9 billion more in gold from most of the 21 other countries it imported from than was declared in exports.
Gold laundering is an international crime because it is mostly run by mafia-type organizations, where killing and other type of violence, plus sexual abuse of women, forced prostitution, are a daily occurrence. It's actually the law of the day, you could almost say, in these illegal gold mining areas. There should be an international law enforceable, issued by the UN, if at all possible, and enforced. It must be enforced by the International Criminal Court against anything to do with gold laundering.
Gold's small size and high price make it a suitable target for smuggling, and the UAE's minimal control and regulations have turned the country into a magnet for the metal. The situation has become so dire that the London Bullion Markets Association called on Dubai and other gold hubs to conform to the regulatory standards or face a blacklisting of their exports. While the UAE has promised more transparency, only time will tell how and to what extent the country will fulfill its pledge.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. stories from different parts of the world. The Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, brothers and sisters. Thank you so very much for joining us on today's episode of The Lantern. As always, it's a pleasure and honor to have a share of a few moments of your day as we reflect upon the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam in the form of everyday stories, stories regarding great personalities and figures, anecdotes, analogies. Because at the end of the day, we do what we can in order to find a glimpse of the light of truth in our lives. The story we're going to be discussing today is very similar to that of Nabi Ayyub alayhi salam, which we've talked about on our show, I think, on several occasions. So let's listen to the story real quick, and we'll see how this story is similar to that of the Prophet of God.
In the name of Allah, dear friends, so welcome to this program, Lantern. Today's story is entitled Feeling Pleased with Whatever Pleases Allah. One of the students of Sheikh Behjat, the great scholar, says, "One day I went to the house of Sheikh Behjat a few minutes before the start of the class, because often the Sheikh used to attend the classroom. And he would narrate a story or a tradition or a moral lesson till all the students attend. Luckily, as I entered, he came to the room early and said this to me after the greeting and the salutation. In the city of Najaf, a handsome Iranian youth was with us from the people of Hamadan, and he was famous for being neat and physically well-formed. One day, this youth became paralyzed to the extent he could not walk except after leaning on a cane. I tried not to meet him due to his particular condition. Therefore, I used to avoid meeting him so I would not add one more grief to his griefs. One day, I got out of the alley and saw him standing in the street, so I had no choice except to meet him. Without contemplating, I asked him, 'How do you feel?' But I was upset with having said so and kept saying this to myself, 'What empty talk is this? Do you not see in what condition he is?' But contrary to my expectation, when he opened his mouth to answer my question, his speech was like cool water with which he put out what I had felt inside. He kept praising and thanking Allah with a spirit filled with activity and pleasure, as if he was drowned in blessings of Allah, the praised and the most exalted one. I felt relieved and my grief departed from me."
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
In the story of this man that we heard about, he was known for his appealing appearance, but he was crippled and he was paralyzed. The same was the story of Nabi Ayyub alayhi salam, if you guys remember. He was known for being like above blessed, especially blessed, whether it was about having many good children, whether it was regarding his wealth, his harvest, his crops, his livestock, you know, him being loved by his community and the tribe that he lived in, and shoop, Allah takes all of that away from him. And Nabi Ayyub alayhi salam is still grateful. The point of that, however, isn't that Allah is going to give you a blessing and then take it away from you. Because obviously, Allah is not a child with an ant farm. He's not a bully, na'udhu billah. He wants us to, number one, be happy. He genuinely wants us to be happy, because unless we are happy, we won't be able to engage in other productive activities in our life, whether it's acts of worship, whether it's contributing to the society we're living in, whether it's academic activities and growth. Unless we're happy, and by happiness, I don't mean that euphoric buzz of adrenaline in our body, the same feeling I get after watching a nice movie or having really good chocolate with chai. By happiness, I mean that state of being and mind where I'm elevated, that state of being and mind where I feel a constant flow of energy within myself. I'm motivated, I'm driven, I have an inner encouragement and strive to do better, to be better, to do good things. That's the kind of happiness Allah wants for us. And depending on our capacity and the situation that we're in, He lets us experiment with different occasions and events in order to find that level of happiness within us. So when it comes to trials and tests, Allah puts us again in scenarios that elevate that sense of drive within us. And also, like we said, Allah wants us to grow. So, and that's the main objective. It is upon us to be able to find that state of happiness and inner contentment and strive in every situation that Allah puts us in. The other thing about putting us through tests that we hate, like the Quran says, "Asa an takrahu shay'an wa huwa khayrun lakum." Often do you hate something, but it's actually good for you. I'm not going to bring in the whole bitter medicine analogy thing. But I am going to say that He puts us through those tests so we can realize one thing. There's a hadith from one of the infallibles, alayhim salawatullah wassalam, that says one of the levels of giving thanks to Allah is to realize that a blessing is from God directly without considering any of the mediums. Sometimes we get so involved in these mediums, in these middle factors, these middlemen, when we receive a blessing, that we forget entirely that it was Allah who is responsible for this bounty that has been bestowed upon us. Like, when it comes to beauty, we are so quick to say, well, good genes, you know, my mom was pretty and my dad was handsome and, you know, they got married and the result is a beautiful child. Well, I could have seriously picked up the worst genes. I mean, no one's perfect. I could have picked up the worst genes in both parents, but Allah decided to bless me or her or him or whoever with the best of each world. That within itself is a test, and I have to recognize that. I'm not saying that I have to be in a constant state of anxiety that, oh my God, this blessing has been given to me. When is it going to be taken away? But I must be in a constant state of awareness. I must be on the edge of my seat, in the sense that I do not neglect this blessing that Allah has given to me. I do not neglect the source of this blessing. I do not misuse this blessing. I must constantly be cautious, aware, and careful that I don't waste this blessing. And wasting this blessing could mean a lot of things. It could mean not giving enough gratitude for it, not expressing enough gratitude for it, or using it in a way that it was not meant to be used, or not using it at all.
That's all the time that we have for today's episode of The Lantern. Thank you for being with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
everyone, this is John. Welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent. Our program covers the political, economic, and social issues of a region which hosts almost 25% of the global population. We will try to explain the issues, break down controversies surrounding them, and try to have some external perspectives from experts and people.
In this special episode for the martyrdom anniversary of Iranian General Qasem Soleimani, we will explore how the U.S. state terrorism and assassinations are helping Takfiri terrorist groups thrive across the countries of the subcontinent, especially in Afghanistan and Pakistan.
The assassination of General Qasem Soleimani is one of the most significant and consequential turning points in the recent history of the region, and will have myriads of geopolitical implications for many countries across the subcontinent and for many years to come. The martyrdom anniversary of the commander serves as a reminder of how the United States military interventions and drone assassinations are aggravating the security of the region and empowering the failed terrorism.
General Qasem Soleimani was an icon of war against extremism, a beacon of hope for the people of the region, and the epitome of those who are bigger than themselves. Although he was martyred in the very early days of 2020, he was commemorated all year round as his influence on the world lingers beyond the boundaries of time and place. Washington used a drone to assassinate the commander of Iran's Quds Force, which is an elite division of the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps. The general, along with deputy head of Iraq's popular mobilization units and other companions, was targeted by the drone strike outside Baghdad International Airport on a direct order from U.S. President Donald Trump on January 3rd, 2020. Iran says the assassination was the biggest gift to Takfiri terrorism, highlighting that this is an act of international terrorism perpetrated against the most effective force in battles against terrorist outfits in the region, such as Daesh, al-Nusra, or al-Qaeda. Leader of the Islamic Revolution Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei has warned that severe revenge awaits the criminals who have stained their hands with his blood. The U.S. says this was done for the safety of Americans, but how can they feel safe while they are worriedly expecting retaliation, especially around his martyrdom anniversary?
Country or entity kills a senior official of another country in a third country. How come is the global community so unforthcoming about calling out and condemning terrorism only when it is done by the United States? Washington tries to justify its state terrorism under guises of self-defense and counter-terrorism. But almost all human beings, even American authorities and politicians themselves, are cognizant of the fact that using assassination drones on foreign soil is wrong, illegal, and unjust, to say the least.
drone killings are blatantly against the international law, and assassinations of foreign leaders is still technically prohibited in the U.S. under an executive order issued by President Ford in 1976 and still in force. The United Nations Charter only permits a military attack if an armed attack occurs on the defending nation, and the U.S. Constitution only allows it in self-defense. None was the case here. Despite the Trump administration's efforts to make their decision look less illegal and illogical, the notion of preemptive self-defense sounds oxymoronic, both logically and morally. Washington has, for long, used assassination drones in violation of the international law. When the Obama administration was increasing the use of drone assassinations, right-wingers even criticized him for the practice, but Trump took it to a new level of lawlessness. He unleashed a flood of portentous implications for the world and compromised an already fraught investment of thousands of American lives and trillions of dollars in the region. It is not the first time the U.S. leaders move to ignite the flames of war somewhere and then start lying to cover up their faulty analysis and their uncalculated actions. The Vietnam War was triggered based on lies about the Gulf of Tonkin incident, and the Iraq War was started based on a web of deceit about aluminium tubes, yellow cake uranium, and bogus ties between Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda.
Now, for more on this, we are joined by Mr. Feroz Mithiborwala, who's an activist and commentator. Mr. Mithiborwala, welcome back to the subcontinent. So, many people around the world believe that General Qasem Soleimani played an important role in the fight against terrorism. The United States, however, assassinated the general last year, and the U.S. president dared to call him a terrorist, while the terrorist group Daesh, in a statement, praised the assassination. What's your reading of all of this there in India?
Essentially, the United States of America, its military, and its the Pentagon and the CIA and the FBI is known for its terrorist activities within America and all across the world. The fact is that General Qasem Soleimani was the hero, is the hero of the war against ISIS, of the terror of ISIS in Iraq and Syria, and he led the war against ISIS in both in Syria and in Iraq, and defeated ISIS. That is the reality of the situation, and any good human being understands that matter. So for the Mossad and the CIA to assassinate General Qasem Soleimani, and then they, you know, calling him a terrorist and all is utterly ridiculous, because ISIS was built by the CIA, the Israelis, the Saudis, as well as by Turkish intelligence, and finally they have been defeated. Thanks to General Qasem Soleimani, who was actually the central figure in this entire war against terror.
All right, assassinating an official visiting another country on an invitation, sending drones to countries killing many civilians and calling it collateral damage in their so-called fight against terrorism. And that is while the United States supported many Takfiri terrorists in Iraq, Syria, and elsewhere. We also saw them, quote, accidentally airdropping weapons to terrorists. Do we need them to do anything else to conclude that they are in fact involved in both state terrorism and state sponsoring of terrorism?
No, undoubtedly. Old record, going back all the way to the South Americas, those countries have suffered a lot by the fact that they've supported militias and all kind of terrorist activities in South America and across the world. Both in Syria and in Iraq, the evidence is so strong of their supporting ISIS and other Takfiri groups, including letting them smuggle the oil out of Syria into Iraq and Turkey and all the way into Israel, it is all, and into Europe, it is all very clear actually. They supplied ISIS in Mosul with the lead, you know, with, I mean, the kind of arsenal that ISIS had was not of a terrorist group. ISIS is an army of terror, and they were funded and financed and weaponized by the Americans. So the evidence is also strong, and it was actually General Flynn who had said that ISIS is the willful creation of the White House. So why? ISIS was created by the CIA and the Mossad and by the Saudi intelligence. There's no doubt about it. Which is why General Qasem Soleimani was assassinated. Because he was sent to a central role in challenging the imperialist Zionist occupation of the region and their Takfiri allies. And which is also why America till date is not part of the International Criminal Court. Because they are
indulging in criminal terrorist activities, bombing, killing, assassinating, drone attacks.